Millennium Knife.
Hello, everyone.
A podcast of the cinema.
It sure is.
Tell your name. Let's get all the information out of the in the right
out the gate.
Yes,
like we were professionals.
Yes.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor of The Wrap and a film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Dave White. I'm here to rock you.
The KLF is going to rock you. You are something else.
I'm the film critic for Movies.com.
Yep.
It's great.
They were on the case this week.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, in previous episodes...
What could you be referring to? I don't think you're referring to anything. You should not refer to things. You should never refer to things.
I'm following up on things
you should never be you referring to anything.
Yes, movies.com. They're great.
My employer. This is a podcast of the cinema.
Yes.
I think I mentioned that once before.
I think you did.
What cinemas are we discussing today?
This week we are talking about Insurgent, The Gunman,
yep.
It Follows,
yep.
And then I saw Three Hearts, and
what's that?
French film with...
oh, wow, that was like...
Yeah, that opened.
3 weeks ago that you saw that, though.
And
so it finally opened this week.
Yes.
Okay.
And I Can't Stand Losing You. The documentary about the police.
No.
You are such a baby.
No.
You give me a hard time when I don't want to hear, you know, like, Corpse Fart or whatever kind of bands you're listening to. But you are such a whiny baby about the police. Like, they're just the worst. Which they are not.
Name three bands that are worse than the police.
Air Supply.
Maybe.
The Hooters.
Maybe.
Three Doors Down. Slipknot, Nickelback. I could go on all day. There's lots of bands worse than the police.
Okay, there are other bands worse than the police.
And I like the police. They nice to the police.
No, they not nice.
The documentary reminded me that I want to go dig up their early albums.
Great. You can do that with headphones on.
I will do that, because I'm considerate. The way that you are admittedly considerate to me when you're listening to Corpse Fart.
Yeah. There's no such thing as that band, by the way. That band is not a name. That's not a name of a band.
Don't act like there couldn't be. It's just that no one's thought of it yet. Or there is, and that you haven't gotten their Split 7 yet. I'm operating within the realm of possibility here, and you know it. You were just talking about some song called Ghost Fart the other day or something, weren't you, on this program?
Ghost Boner, right?
Yes, farting. Ghost Boner. Oh, so, yes, all right, yes, Ghost Boner, forgive me.
All right, wait, Can't Stand Losing You, Three Hearts,
uh-huh.
Do You Believe...
Oh, Do You Believe? How could I leave out Do You Believe? Oh, good heavens.
Insurgent.
Gunman. And It Follows.
Gunman, It Follows. We're catching up on It Follows. Yeah. That's six movies.
Yeah.
That we're talking about.
Yeah.
All right, well, you better make it snappy then.
Oh, really?
Yes. No lollygagging around or talking about things.
Or else what? Big man.
We're going to be... Well, first of all, the one thing, we'll be late for our special opera that day.
We have time to do a show and get to the opera.
No, we got to leave here at like 12:30.
Yeah, we have time.
It's not a lot of time. So, just mark my words.
Uh-huh. How shall I mark them?
Insurgent. Let's begin discussing Insurgent.
Oh, sure. So it's a sequel to Divergent, which I barely remember, except that I didn't like it, and I don't like this one either. It's this dumb future dystopia where everyone is good at only one thing, and if you are good at one and a half things, then they throw you into science jail because you are a threat to society. and where all the smart people are evil and where all the nice people get walked on.
Pretty much.
Yeah. But then there's the one unique girl who is different from all the others because she can do five things.
They've got factions.
Yes.
Hateration.
Mm-hmm.
Fluffiness.
Uh-huh.
That's the other faction.
Okay. Minty.
Minty. Boring dudes.
Mm-hmm.
And the hornies.
I want to see that movie. I would much rather see a movie about Minty and the hornies.
Those are the factions.
Yeah. The big news here is that the director of RIPD and the Time Traveler's Wife is still getting gigs.
Yeah.
And is getting, like, plum franchise, you know, sequel gigs.
Yes. Well, he's a director for hire.
Well, yeah, but...
And they hired him.
But at what point do people think maybe there's another director for hire who hasn't made, like, some of the worst movies of the last
decade? I don't know that this is his fault. I mean...
No, this would have been terrible in anyone's hands. But
each time at bat...
But why do you go to him?
I bet you they go to him
because... I'm sure he gets it done on time and on budget.
I bet you he gets it done on time, on budget, and he takes notes without complaint.
Oh, that's true.
I bet that's what happens too.
Yeah. I don't know this person at all. Art getting in the way.
He may very well have like a.
He could be a visionary.
He may be a visionary. We just haven't seen that vision yet.
Mm-hmm.
Joe.
Robert Schwenke.
Robert. Steve.
Schwenke.
Okay. Well, but I'm the.
Which sounds like he should be one of those guys.
Nothing but bad films.
He should be one of those guys in like the Da Bears sketches. Joining us this week is Bob Schwenke.
I say honestly that I don't think this is his fault. I think that
I can't see that
the source material
anybody
here
could have really done much with this.
Is so derivative and so dull and so not anything. Now, here's how I know. There's people on Facebook say things to me like, have you read the books? And I'm like, no!
Of course not.
Of course I haven't read these books.
What do you take me for?
First of all, you can buy them in an airport. And as you know, that is my rule. If you can buy that book in an airport, I'm not reading it.
No. Because I was in an airport once where they had an entire section that was like To Kill a Mockingbird and Jane Austen and like actual good books.
That was on accident.
Well, I'm just saying.
Somebody at that bookstore was like, haha, I'm going to ruin this bookstore with
literature. It was like some chain and they clearly had, it was like a different color. Like it was a look, we have non-crap, everyone. They were very proud of us.
There's someone from the airport standing there waving their arms in the direction.
The guy with the two batons, yeah.
All right, I may have to modify that rule.
Okay.
But in general, I'm right.
You could probably also get them from the Scholastic Book Club, if that's still a thing.
Right. Anyway, no, I'm not reading these books.
Yeah.
And I worry about friends who have read them. Like, I'm not judging them. I just want to make sure...
That they're also reading
other things.
Joan Didion.
I just want, like, okay, it's fine. Yes, I like candy.
But you eat kale.
But also. I know I better eat some kale. And some broccoli and all the things.
Quinoa.
I need all my greens as well.
Your superfoods.
This book is not a superfood.
No.
This book is a...
It's a peach it's a, now and later.
It's a pooper food. It's just...
It's a banana Laffy Taffy.
You don't have an original thought in your head.
No.
And yet now you've got a major bestseller with a four-picture franchise.
Yes.
In a
world that makes no sense at all. I mean, when I reviewed it for the rap and I pointed out all the similarities to all the other YA books and whatever, and it got the usual me, 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 your comments. Fine. Let's put all that aside. The fact that everything in it is lifted from another similar, better series of books. This world doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And so everything in this book is built around this world and how it operates and whether or not they stay there or overthrow it or blah, blah, blah. And so if I don't get into the world, then that keeps me from getting into anything else.
Correct. Furthermore, this sequel is it's a placeholder. It's a wheel spinner. It exists just to set up the last two films.
Okay, but you know, you could say the same thing about Catching Fire, and that was really good.
Right. And so, given the fact that there's nothing really going on in this world other than the usual YA stuff,
mm-hmm.
we don't have any reason to cheer anybody on.
Yeah, there's no stakes.
Yeah. However, I did learn after my review posted, and people started reading it, that a thing happens in the third and final book. Mm-hmm. The book is called Allegiant.
Yeah.
And they're going to make Allegiant Part 1 and Allegiant Part 2 films.
Because they can.
Because Hollywood is already a dystopia. And a very, very, very major thing happens. Like, a shocking thing happens. Which is the one...
Saving grace.
Saving grace. Like, yeah. If I'm going to applaud the author of these books for any reason, it's going to be for this shocking event that happens in the third book.
Which probably won't happen until the second movie.
I guarantee you it will not happen until the second movie. So, I mean, or maybe I won't guarantee you, because clearly...
You haven't read it.
I had this big idea that I could predict everything coming in my review, and apparently I'm wrong.
Meh.
Yeah.
I will say... One thing that really bugged me about this is I think Shailene Woodley has been, up till now, a really good actress.
She's great.
I never watched Secret Life of the American Teenager.
I'm a fan of her.
On screen, I liked her a great deal in what was the Clooney movie?
She's the new Molly Ringwald.
What was the Clooney movie?
She's very appealing, and she's very everyday.
Okay, will you please answer my question?
The Descendants.
The Descendants, thank you. I liked her in The Descendants. I even kind of liked
her... Sorry, Professor. I thought you'd have knocked that up all by yourself.
In the first one of these, this is the first movie that I've seen her do some bad acting. There is a scene where she is shot up with truth serum, and she is so overdoing it. In my review, I said it was like they shot her up with ham juice.
Jokes!
You gotta liven things up somehow. Anyway.
Speaking of ham juice.
Yes.
Before we started recording, I heard you call your coffee Do It Fluid.
Yeah.
But first of all, I've never heard that before in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I want you never to say it again.
You're not the boss of me.
No, in this instance, I think I'm going to assert my bossness.
You thought it was funny when I said it.
Because it was so weird. Where did that come from?
Okay. Here's where I heard it, which I'm sure they didn't make it up either. It's probably something that people just used to say. But there is a novelization of Animal House that was written by the guys who wrote the screenplay. It's a big book. It's not like a little, you know, sort of pocket paperback thing. It's lots of illustrations and pictures from the film and stuff.
And yet it is a novelization.
Basically, yeah. But it has a lot of stuff in it that's not in the movie. And, you know, it's fans of the film might want to check it out. I loaned it to our friend David Zeev, who's a huge fan of Animal House, and he really enjoyed it. But anyway, at one point in the book, when Otis Day and the Knights first show up at the frat house, before they go on, they ask one of the frat guys, I forget who, for their Do It Fluid. And he gives them a bottle of gin. And that just sort of stuck in my mind, you know. It just seems like the kind of thing like some old, you know, like blues Jazzbo would say, you know, my Do It Fluid.
Hey, where's my Do It Fluid? Yeah, it sounds... It sounds like sensual lotion. And that's why. I don't want to know.
With a cup of sensuality.
I don't want to know what that... That is also a real thing.
Yeah. That was a wedding gift we got.
Someone gave us... a box of actual tea. I don't know what kind of tea it was, because I immediately got rid of it.
Boner juice tea.
It was called sensuality. Tea. I gotta turn down my laptop volume. Yeah,
would you?
Yeah.
Turn off your phone.
Is my phone turned up? My phone is on. I'm turning down the volume.
Okay.
Just in case someone, one of my many admirers, tries to text me or ring me on my mobile.
Your cellular.
On my cellular. Can we stop talking about Insurgent?
Please.
It's dumb and bad.
Yeah.
It's
there are some
going nowhere until Allegiant Part 4, apparently.
then
it's going to get crazy.
The only parts that are cool are when Shailene Woodley is in this sort of like virtual reality thing, and it just gets her out of the world of the movie and into one that's completely fake, and so that's sort of interesting. And you know, like when a mature actress like Ashley Judd or Octavia Spencer or Kate Winslet pops up, you know, they're kind of fun for a few minutes.
Two things.
Naomi Watts does not work as a brunette.
No. I am pro... In this universe, I am Team Winslet. I am for any dystopian future...
That is run by Kate Winslet.
That is, number one, run by Kate Winslet. Number two, clean. Say what you want about her innate evil, but everyone there has a shower and a bed and a clean living space.
Dave White wants the trains to run on time and the floors to be clean enough to be eaten off of.
This was my thing with The Giver as well.
And with Beast of the Southern Wild.
And Beast of the Southern Wild. Like, why is dirt more authentic? Why does everybody have to run around in leather sportswear, jumping and parkouring and stuff? Why can't they just go to the nice place that's clean, quiet, and has a shower?
Oh, God. Shailene Woodley in this movie. Okay, at the very beginning of the movie, she gives herself a haircut. And, of course, it's one of those self-inflicted haircuts in movies that was obviously the creation of three stylists.
Oh, yeah.
And then she wears this, like, hooded vest that makes her look like she should have been on, like, season three of The L Word.
My favorite.
As, like, the hot young publicist in town.
Yeah, my favorite scene in this is the sex scene.
Mm.
Because it starts with her going, zip! That big, clunky... activewear zipper, zip. Time for sensuality.
And I keep waiting for Jai Courtney to be in a movie where it's not entirely stupid. Like, you know, he was in Jack Reacher, which was pretty good.
Jack Reacher was pretty good.
And then he was in I, Frankenstein.
He's been in some garbagey movies.
He's in a lot of stupid stuff. But it's like that awful Die Hard one, the fifth one,
right?
You know,
but he wasn't bad in it.
But the movie was terrible. I like this guy. There's something about him that like the camera gets it. You know?
Oh yeah. He has
a presence, but boy, he's stuck in these movies that are terrible.
He's super good looking. He's a badass.
Yeah,
and he's gonna be in something eventually. That clicks.
I worry he's gonna be the new Sam Worthington, you know.
Well, who knows what's gonna happen to him, but he's got that action star vibe.
Yeah.
I just want a dystopia that's nice. You could have one, apparently. Like, they all start off with the Giver's the worst one. The Giver's the one where seriously, everything's great. And the only
problem is... You cannot say bad swears in the Giver world.
The only problem is...
That would drive you crazy.
Is that you cannot have emotions, which is fine.
They're overrated.
They're overrated anyway. And you can't tell people you love them, which is also, who cares?
Yeah.
You know?
You'd be running around like Katie Holmes going, precision of language!
Yeah! They give you a bike. Everybody gets their own bike.
Mm-hmm.
You get this... sweet, like, pod to live in.
You get meds every day.
You get cool food blocks to eat. This is not a bad life. I'm honestly pro evil and fascism as long as things are nice.
As long as it's tidy.
As long as it's tidy. I just want a shower. I want a house that's got a roof. I don't want to live in a tree house with hippies that grow tomatoes.
You want
all day.
A gleaming cube.
Yeah. My needs are few. But they are specific.
Yes, very much so. You can be had by any totalitarian with a spray bottle of Fantastic.
Yes.
Moving on. The Gunman.
The Gunman.
Yeah.
This is from the director of Taken.
It is.
Pierre Morel. Yes. He also directed...
2 Days in Paris.
Yes. And
But a good one also.
Unknown, did he also direct Unknown?
No, that's Joe McAlay, so
okay, okay.
Something else. Hang on, I'll look. You vamp.
And, not vamping, I'm just going to...
Well, just keep talking about The Gunman. Information. And come back to this.
Sean Penn is the lead, and of the current crop of older actors...
Oh, The Transporter, 1 and 2.
The Transporter, 1 and 2, okay. Of the current crop of older actors...
Oh, and District B-13.
...who are becoming... action stars.
Right.
He's the youngest. He's 54, 55.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah, he's only a few years older than me.
You are old.
I know. I don't deny. But the... So he's been going around selling to me like, look, I'm not an aging action star. Like, he's been actually saying this out loud. In the interviews, like, don't lump me in with Liam Neeson and Kevin Costner and Denzel Washington, all of whom are 60 or over.
Right, right. I'm young.
I'm young, man. I'm Spicoli. You know, like, it's not. Here's the thing. The minute you turn 50, and I know this for a fact because it happened to me, AARP knows where you are. And they find you. They sent me my membership information. They sent me my card.
But when do you actually get to join?
They said, I have to pay them some money if I want to join. Oh, I want to join, you have to pay
money. But at 50, you can join.
You can join at 50.
Oh, well, get on it. There's discounts to be
had. A discount on life insurance. Actually, you know what? They sent me a list of discounts. Uh-huh. At 50, your discounts are limited to like a handful of places.
Oh, okay.
They start kicking in at 55.
Oh.
So I turned 51 this year. Four years from now, savings will be mine in a variety of locations.
All the 4:30 buffets.
Right now, Krispy Kreme, you get 10% off at Krispy Kreme.
That alone would save us millions
and
a year.
Krispy Kreme's fine, and it's not saving us any money because we almost never go.
I know. They're not nearby.
Apparently, Banana Republic...
Really?
If you're over 50, you get like a 10% discount at Banana Republic, which is weird. Mm-hmm. They don't want you in the store when you're 50. I know that.
Not when you wear
50. Because in the popular imagination, to be 50 is to actually be 750. You might as well like have a cane and, you know, a walker. Well,
is there like a midway point in the game of life? I think that's like you've hit that. You know?
It's all the slide.
Begin downhill.
The slide to death begins here, everyone. So, honestly, because Sean Penn is the producer and the
co-writer,
the credited co-writer and the star, you can tell he wants this to be something more meaningful. Mm-hmm. It opens in the Congo. He is a man with a particular set of skills who is employed to use them for very, very, very dark purposes.
Yes.
But he's romancing an aid worker played by...
I forget her name, too.
Italian actress who's actually pretty good in the film.
She's okay.
Jasmine Trinca?
Maybe. The movie never...
That's her name.
The movie never explains why she's a surgeon when they're in the Congo, but then when she's back in Spain, she's suddenly teaching elementary school.
Yeah. That doesn't make sense.
No. Jasmine Trinca, yes.
Yeah. the he does a bad thing there. Horrible, horrible consequences result. 8 years later in 2014, he's being pursued and someone's trying to kill him. So he has to jump all around from country to country. He's got to go to London. He's got to go to Barcelona to
look up the old gang.
Look up the old associates who have all changed their ways somewhat. Like, they're all still bad guys.
They're all legit-ish.
But they all wear suits, and yeah. So they get away with a whole lot more. And so he wants to find out from them who's trying to kill him. Because they're the only ones who would know. So clearly one of them is setting him up. And then later you find out who and why and
blah, blah, blah. I have issues with this movie.
Yeah, you do. Me too. You talk first.
Well, okay. So first of all, the thing about the whole sort of social responsibility angle, it's kind of wedged in at the beginning and then at the end. And then there's a whole subplot about how, because of the life that he has led, that his brain...
It's leaded.
Leaded. Because of the life that he has leadered, his brain is covered with plaque that he exhibits...
Cumulative trauma to the brain.
Yeah. He exhibits Alzheimer's-like symptoms.
So that's an interesting subplot. Like, he's being sort of attacked inside and outside.
Yeah, and it puts him in a cool quandary in that the activities that will kill him are ones that he has to do again or someone will kill him.
Yes.
But again, introduced at the beginning, doesn't come up again until the end. Like, it is forgotten for big, long stretches of this movie.
I know.
You know, so that we can see him, you know, jump through skylights and, you know, shoot people from distant angles.
And take off his shirt.
Take off his shirt.
Bunch.
Oh, yeah. And take showers and have sex and, like, I've been to the gym. This is what Charlize Theron's getting every night, you guys. So I just found that really frustrating. And yeah, Bibbs and I were talking about this on What the Flick this week, and he very much disagrees with me, but I think this is one of the worst Javier Bardem performances I have ever seen. He's so, like, scenery-chewing and glowering and obvious. All of his intentions are so obvious.
He has to play an alcoholic, and he's really going for it. The
opening sequence
where
they're in the Congo and Sean Penn is making out with Jasmine Trinka.
And he's staring holes in it.
Exactly. Like he's Torgo or something. I was like, ouch. I just felt bad for him.
But again, because of the whole, you know, brain subplot and the humanitarian aid subplots.
Mm-hmm.
This is. I don't know if these elements were in the original novel,
right, or if Penn just shoehorned them in.
But clearly, Penn has an affinity for the idea of this like person trying to become noble, become a good person,
yeah,
instead of the horrifying person he was before,
right.
And the film really backs away from those nightmarish consequences of his actions as well as the actions of the other guys.
Well, it tries to assume.
It talks about them occasionally, but it never goes there in really showing you the devastation that they cause.
Yeah, and it tries to assume that his, like, small individual actions are somehow making up for this giant awful thing that he does,
yeah,
that has, like you said, huge repercussions, you know, on a global scale. So it's
like he should be tried in international court and imprisoned for the rest of his life.
He should be at the Hague naming names and not digging wells, you know.
Yeah. So it's
kind of a crock.
I find the film's sort of inability to commit to that incredibly problematic. And there's a final shot that is, it's offensive. The final scene is offensive. You will see it maybe and feel like, oh, that's okay, that's sweet. Well, it shouldn't be sweet.
No.
It's actually offensive. So there's some fun action stuff going on in here,
sure,
some good neck stabbing. But it's
the main sort of like bad guy in the field that Penn has to go mano a mano with a few times.
Yeah.
He's pretty cool.
Right.
He's this like Scandinavian actor whose name I don't have in front of me, but
right.
Like, he makes for a good nemesis. But yeah, generally speaking, and yeah, it's really annoying these movies that want to talk about big issues and then either let the people off way too lightly, or the opposite, which is almost as annoying, which is, I won't name it because it would be considered a spoiler, but there's a film that I saw at Venice last year. It's going to be opening in the States this year. That's all about kind of like real estate shenanigans and the kind of stuff that they do to evict people, even though it was illegal and yada, da, da, da.
This is a documentary?
No, this is a narrative film.
Oh, okay.
And then at the end of the movie, like, the bad real estate guy gets arrested. And I'm like, on what planet was this movie set? Because it's not this one. Nobody gets arrested for this stuff. No one serves time. No, none of the people that engineered the Wall Street crash or the real estate, and none of these guys ever get arrested. So don't sell me that one, movie.
Yeah, movie. All right. I want you to quickly... run through. Can't stand. I can't even finish this word.
Oh, shut up.
And those French one you saw with your brother.
Fine. All right. Can't Stand Losing You is a documentary about the police, except it's really a documentary about Andy Summers, except it's a documentary about Andy Summers only in terms of the police. It's weird. It's based on his memoir, apparently, and he narrates the film. So even though there are three points of view about this band, you only hear one of them. I mean, and you know, sort of the structure of the band, of the film is, you know, they got together for a reunion tour in 2010, I think. And there's all this footage of them backstage and performing and yada-da. And you see the three of them interacting backstage and talking about stuff, whatever. But
Andy is the short one.
He's the guitarist.
Then there's the tall drummer one.
Stuart Copeland.
Then there's the old Stingaroo.
And the old Stingaroo. That's what they call it. And the computer at Amoeba, apparently, they refer to as the old Stingaroo. So it's not like they couldn't have gotten interviews with Stuart Copeland and the old Stingaroo if they'd wanted to, but they didn't want to. Like, they, you know, or maybe they said no. I don't know. But like they exist in the margins of this movie, except, you know, in like the... you know, old footage. It's an interesting movie. I had no idea Andy Summers was so dang old. Like, he played with Eric Burdon and the Animals in the 60s. Yeah, he was like, it's almost this kind of Spinal Tap thing where, like, you know, his first big band in London, like, they're all wearing suits and skinny ties.
How old is he?
And then they, like, go all psychedelic. He was already 30 in the early 70s. So by the time the police became a big thing, he was in his 40s.
Whoa! He's 72 years old.
Yeah.
He was born the year my mom was born.
So, you know, it's an interesting story because, I mean, the police were only really around for about 5 years. And
that's
they put
what
out,
money will do for you. Boy, he looks all right.
He does. He's got like an, you know, in Hawaii now or something. You know, and it
keeps you young. Yeah. All that cash.
That band was around for 5 years. They had five albums. And then they, by the time it was over, they just could not be in each other's company anymore. Like, you could, like, they all got.
I wonder why.
They all got more and more ego driven. Apparently, Synchronicity was recorded. They were in separate rooms in the same house.
Just fess up.
What?
This podcast is recorded in different buildings. Shh. I'm across the street.
Maintain the illusion.
I can't. I can't be near him. His ego is astounding.
If you like the police, which I did, there's interesting stuff in there. And
pause it. I'm fixing to sneeze.
Okay, sneeze over. If you like the police, there's interesting footage and photos. Apparently, at some point, Summers picks up a camera and started like taking pictures of everything. And I think he even has a published book of the photos that he took of like their last several tours or whatever. But it's weird because the movie, like I said, no perspective from the other two dudes in the band. And then two, once the police is over, even if we're watching this for Summers' story, he has nothing. He doesn't talk about his life after the band. So between them breaking up in 1984 and then them getting together for this reunion in 2010, nothing. Like, you know, we find out that he got back together with the wife that he had divorced and they had more kids. But that's it. And so it's a weirdly assembled piece. I find it's kind of unsatisfying, but just for the collection of old, you know, TV interviews and stuff like that, fans of the band will be interested. Non-fans of the band will not care.
That's me.
Yes, I know. But it, like I said, it did encourage me to go, oh yeah, I want to listen to, you know, Outlando's D'Amour again. It's been a while. You know, and it's kind of funny that they all kind of came up through the punk scene, but realized very quickly that they weren't punk. And apparently when Sting wrote Roxanne, it originally had kind of a bossa nova beat to it, and they were like, we cannot do this, they will kill us. So they did a reggae beat instead, and that's, you know, then that worked.
It sure did.
God, you're the worst. Anyway.
Talk about the French movie now.
Okay, the French movie, which I found rather disappointing. Three Hearts, it stars three of my favorite actresses, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Chiara Mastroianni, and Catherine Deneuve. And there's this guy, and he misses a train, and he winds up bumping into Charlotte Gainsbourg, and they spend the night walking around and smoking and talking about their misery and have this immediate connection. And they're supposed to meet up on Friday in Paris, and she, like, plans to leave her husband. And he gets into some sort of, like, car accident on the way there, and he gets there late, and she's already left because she assumes he didn't show up, so she goes back to her husband, and then they wind up, like, moving to America. And then, randomly, a year later, he meets this woman, and played by Chiara Mastroianni, and they hit it off, and they become a thing. And then it turns out, wah, wah, the two women are sisters! And it's a farcical setup, but it's not a comedy.
Right.
And if you're going to play this for drama, you need to establish some real reason why the three of them don't sit down over a glass of wine and go, funny story. So there's just a lot of gnashing of teeth for no good reason, and I never really kind of bought into the central dilemma of the film. And then the lead guy, like, is a, he works for the French IRS, basically. And there's this whole subplot about how he's going to be auditing the mayor of the town where they live,
yeah,
right before the election. That goes nowhere.
Huh.
I found it really frustrating. It's directed by Benoît Jacquot. And I don't think it works. It's like you've got I always bring this up. If you have a plot that where the whole thing could be solved by 1 5-minute conversation, there need to be really interesting, powerful circumstances that explain why that conversation isn't happening. And I just never bought it.
Well,
the end.
Now we caught up on It Follows.
Yes.
It's pretty dang good.
Yeah, I warn that it is being a little oversold, because
it depends on how you're describing the overselling.
I just some of the reviews that I've read, I really was expecting this to be more. There's a lot that I liked about it.
Can you say more again, just the way you just now said it?
More.
Can you do it? Can you do it again?
No.
Can you do it over and over and over?
No, I will not.
But I want you to.
No. I liked it a lot. There's a lot of really inventive ideas about it. I like the tone of it. I like the look of it. The performances are good. It's enigmatic in ways that I think aren't always to its benefit.
Mm.
But, you know, it's worth
seeing.
We
can't tell you anything about it.
I'd rather not.
Yeah, it's. Well,
we can tell you the basics.
It is not a slasher film, and it is not a demonic possession film.
Correct.
But it's about some suburban teenagers.
Right.
And freaky stuff starts happening to
one of them.
One of them. And she has to enlist the help of others for physical assistance.
We can tell a little of
it. I don't think we can.
Now, other reviews have explained the basic plot, which is that a young woman has sex for the first time, and after that happens, she begins seeing these
people.
These people who are coming for her.
Following her.
Yeah.
Walking
toward her. And the guy that she has sex with explains that that somebody slept with him and it started happening to him.
I really wish we weren't talking about this.
Sweetie, this is the basic stuff. You would read this in the Sundance catalog. This is the first, the beginning of the first act.
Okay, fine. I walked in cold.
Okay, well, that's nice.
I walked in cold.
And explain.
I would like to listen.
It
hasn't opened wide yet.
But it's anybody who's written about this film or talked about this film tells you this much. I'm not telling that much.
All right, fine.
You went in cold because you didn't read anything. If people want to go in cold, right. They won't be listening to this episode.
That's right. Horror movies, I don't read anything before going.
Anyway, so he basically tells her that what she has to do to make this stop happening is to sleep with somebody else. Even though he can still see them. Anyway, and it goes from there. It's directed by the guy who did The Myth of the American Sleepover, which I have not seen.
I have.
But I understand it's very... Somebody told me that they're the same movie, just this one's a horror film. Like, they're both basically about suburban teens kind of sitting around doing nothing.
Pretty much. Yeah. The Myth of the American Sleepover was literally about kids sitting around doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about kids who wish they could be sitting around doing nothing, except something is after them.
Right.
I tell you what I really love about this. I love how, with very few tools, mm-hmm. very few, elements, he creates an almost persistent feeling of dread.
Mm.
And tension. Every scene, no matter what's going on, you're thinking, what's coming? What's going to happen in this scene? Like, why? So there's that, which is great. The other thing I was into was the intentional ambiguity.
Of when this is all happening.
Of when it's happening. Because if you're paying attention to the surroundings...
The cars, the clothes.
The cars are old, but then you see some new cars.
Mm-hmm.
The clothes are sort of timeless, like dressed down, sort of teenage wear.
Or they could be arguably vintage.
The homes are all, like, they look like they're from about 1981.
Mm-hmm. The TVs are big.
The landline phones are hooked to the wall. They're wall phones.
Yeah, nobody has cell phones.
The TVs are big. No flat screens.
But one girl has an e-reader.
Yeah.
But that's inside of like a clamshell compact.
Yeah. So there's all sorts of weird anachronistic details in the production design.
Yeah. No, that's what I like. The score.
The score is very cool.
It's very unsettlingly moogie.
John Carpenter.
Yeah, totally.
And... I loved how it doesn't all fit together. I loved how there was even more intentional ambiguity in the narrative, where details are thrown out at you, and you think, oh, is that a clue? Like, right. Should I be watching for more of that? And then, no. Like, it's just the unexplained, and there's a good handful of unexplained elements. And by the time the film is over, they are still unexplained. And I'm into that because it wasn't the result of sloppiness. It was the result of...
No, I'm sure it was intentional.
I'm just going to throw this in there and screw around with you guys.
Yeah. Here's the thing, and I think one of the reasons that I'm less into it than you are is that for me, the bar has been raised recently on precisely this kind of movie with The Babadook.
Okay.
Which you haven't seen yet.
Still have not seen The Babadook.
I think The Babadook is more effectively creepy and more, I don't know, I think it's a more, on the whole, satisfying film that operates in a similar vein, in terms of fairly realistic, not like, you know, it has sort of this, it has an internal logic with maybe with one thing that's weird, and everything else seems very much of the world that we recognize.
So what you're telling me is you know something that I don't.
That's a given. Anyway, so I, you know, it's not as good as The Babadook, which is my sort of, which of the current crop of horror films, I still think is far and away, you know, great. But this is good. It's a good movie. People should totally see it and talk about it. And like I said, I love a lot of the same elements you did in terms of the time ambiguity, the music, the, you know, the acting, the cinematography. I liked a lot. I liked the sort of autumnal feel of the film. I think maybe if I had heard some people just like going crazy about it beforehand, my expectations might have been more tempered.
Could you say crazy again?
No!
Just now. Please, it's, just one more time.
We're recording this, so you can go back and listen to it as many times as you want.
But I'm sitting here right now.
It's the moment has passed. I can't.
Crazy! There, I just did it.
Yeah, that was eerie.
Just like you.
It was like listening to myself.
Crazy!
Yeah. I'm kind of quoting an Oingo Boingo song.
Okay, so
let's talk about Do You Believe?
BJ Kellogg, listener, you at Christmas time, because you're a lovely person, you sent us Dairy Queen gift cards. We don't deserve these.
No.
But you did it anyway, and we're very grateful.
Oh, yeah. Guess where Do You Believe opened, listeners?
A mall that we have discussed before.
In Burbank.
That many of you have never been to. But it is my favorite mall. The sad, sad Burbank.
Media Center.
And it's not sad because 50% of the stores are mom-and-pop, independently run stores. I love malls like that because they are a rebuke to corporations owning everything.
Right. Because you can walk into any mall in most cities and be anywhere in the country because it's the same stores.
Do I want to go into perfumes and fragrances and et cetera more? And buy a perfume and or and a fragrance? No. I'm not going to do that. But I like that it exists and that someone is shopping there.
You want to rent a tuxedo with a matching hat?
Maybe.
To be a prince at a quinceanera?
I might. I've never been to a quinceanera.
Me neither.
Although...
I saw the movie Quinceanera.
When I was a kid... Slap my dumb face... When I was a young man, as a school teacher in Texas, one of my students who had a quinceañera coming up, and she asked me to be a padrino.
Grandfather,
And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't understand it, so I went and I asked one of the other teachers, and she said, "It's a lovely gesture that she just asked you this." She goes, "But you're on the hook for some presents." And I was like, "I really can't do this." I'm on a first-year teacher salary. She was a lovely girl, though. That was the first. This teacher was like, "Oh, that's really sweet. Don't do it. You're on the hook for presents."
I was just thinking that scene in Itumama.
She goes, "Well, it's going to eat up your whole Saturday."
There's a scene in Itumama Tambien where there's this, like, family, and it's all done very, like, joyously and celebratory, but they basically are, like, they're standing on the opposite side of the highway and holding up a rope and making cars stop and pay a toll to as a gift to their daughter's quinceañera. It's on the one hand charming, and on the other hand, like, a shakedown. So anyway, we did get some Dairy Queen out of the experience.
Yeah, blizzards. Mm. After a really good lunch at the Tamale House. Now that is a place y'all go to.
That's a non-chain place. It's good. Yeah.
Y'all go to Burbank Media Center Mall. You go see Do You Believe? get yourself some lunch at Tamale House.
Yes.
It's on the third level, right across
from the theater.
Family owned. Those tamales are good.
Those are good tamales.
Do You Believe, however,
whew,
that ain't a good movie. In fact, it is incredibly bad.
From the writers of God's Not Dead.
Why don't you tell people? This is Crash.
Yeah.
Not the good one with sex with cars crashes. No. This is the Crash about racism. This is Crash with conservative evangelical Christianity.
Yeah.
Where?
And the same lack of subtlety.
Yeah. Where?
And if you have enough characters, you don't have to write any of them.
help me remember all the characters. There is the preacher played by Ted McGinley.
Right.
And he's married to an actress who's in a lot of Christian films. I can't remember her name. Mm-hmm. There's Lee Majors.
Right.
And Sybil Shepherd. They're a couple. They're old.
Mourning the death of their daughter to a drunk driver.
There's
Mira Sorvino.
Mira Sorvino
is the homeless woman.
Homeless and got a little kid.
La da di la da da.
There's Brian Bosworth.
Right.
And he's an ex-con with cancer.
Right.
There's
a pregnant teen.
There's two crime dudes.
Yes, who are black.
Who are black, and that makes a difference
because
in this context.
They're like almost the only
only black people in the movie, practically, except for Delroy Lindo, who runs around the city with a cross
giant
on wheels,
cross,
telling people, "Do you really believe?" And
the auntie of the black guys. That's about it.
Yeah.
The pregnant Latina teen.
Yes. And then the guy who is the EMT, who's a Christian.
Right. And his wife is a nurse.
Right. And her brother, and she's not a Christian.
Right. Well, she's sort of going along.
She goes to church with him, but she's not down.
Yeah.
And then her brother, who's an Iraq vet.
With PTSD.
With PTSD. And he's trying to kill himself.
Is a suicidal rich girl.
And then there's Alexa Vega, or Pena Vega now is her last name. She changed her. Or maybe that's her.
I think maybe it already was.
But that was her actual last name. She shortened it to Vega for the Spy Kids.
Yeah.
She's grown now.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of a poor little rich girl.
Right.
And she tries to kill herself.
Right.
Snotty
atheist doctor, played by Sean Astin.
Sean Astin is the snooty atheist doctor.
And then his lawyer girlfriend, who's also a woman who's in a bunch of Christian movies.
Right.
Is that everybody?
More or less. So they've all got problems. They all come together. They all intersect with each other. And then at the end, there's a giant car crash pile-up where they're all in a giant car crash together.
Right.
More or less. Like, some of them are not in the car crash. Some of them, like the doctor, he's at the hospital. He's fixing people who were in the car crash.
Right. Car crash in the rain.
In the rain. Yeah, okay. So we're just going to spoil everything that happens in the film.
Yes.
Because you're probably not going to see it until it hits Netflix, if then.
Yes.
So if you don't want to know the ending of Do You Believe, turn off the podcast and
skip ahead like 5 or 10 minutes.
Whatever, yeah. Brian Bosworth's cancer is cured by prayer.
Because he dies for 5 minutes and then comes back. Unfortunately, the pregnant Latina teen is not so lucky and she bleeds out and
she dies.
She dies magically, leaving her baby behind for the preacher and his infertile wife.
Yes. Then, poor little rich girl who tries to kill herself, and PTSD soldier who tries to kill himself.
Try to jump off the same bridge.
They try to jump off the same bridge, but then they go to a coffee house to talk it out.
Instead.
And then they fall in love-ish, kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the implication.
Totally, yes.
So when they really do finally commit suicide,
it'll be so beautiful.
It'll be... it'll be...
When he gets put on
it'll be double the impact.
When he gets put on an 18-month waiting list of the VA before he can see anybody.
Yeah.
Okay, then the snotty lawyer girlfriend was hired by a woman who's a member of the American Humanist Association.
Yeah.
To sue the EMT because he let this guy who'd been crushed under a thing,
like a
deathbed conversion, basically.
He helped the guy get saved before he died.
Yes.
And there was there was nothing. They were all standing around.
Yeah.
Like,
there was nothing to be done.
Nothing to be done. The guy was crushed under this thing that nobody could move.
Right.
And they were there, but there was nothing. Nobody was able to push the thing off.
Yeah. But wife lady is not having it.
And she was angry.
She's going to sue the bricks off of this EMT guy because then, of course, the union and the city won't back him up because of, you know, everyone hates Jesus and all. And the wife, you know, is angry because, you know, they're going to lose everything in this stupid lawsuit because he won't sign a thing basically saying that, you know, he'll never do it again and he's real sorry.
Right.
But then in the big fiery car crash in the rain, he rescues snotty lawyer lady from her car right before it explodes. And she realizes that her life is a lie and she dumps Sean Astin.
Now, the two black crime guys
die.
They both die. But one of them... one of them dies after becoming a Christian.
No, they both die after becoming Christians.
Yes. Yes. And after they commit their crime.
Well, they try to undo it.
They try to undo the crime.
Or they try to give the money to the church.
Yeah,
and
it doesn't work. And then they die. Yeah. Here's the thing.
And then Lee Majors and Sybil Shepherd invite Mira Sorvino and her adorable little daughter to live with them.
And there's the implication that Mira Sorvino and Brian Bosworth are going to become a thing.
Yeah, but also that Mira Sorvino and the little girl will fill the void in the life of Lee Majors and Sybil Shepherd that their dead daughter left behind, because that's not creepy at all.
And so everything, with the exception of Delroy Lindo, every person who fixes something in this movie is white. And every person who has a major problem or tries to kill themselves or is in trouble in some way or is a criminal...
is brown or black.
Is brown or black.
And everybody who dies to teach white people a lesson about life...
is also brown or black. And so, we're not saying that this film is completely racist. But this film is completely racist. And I know that you have already been accused...
Of racism for pointing this out.
For pointing that out in your review that ran on
the web. That is the genius of the modern conservative movement, is that they have declared that this is a post-racial society.
And that racism doesn't mean anything anymore.
Right, so that if you point out racism, you, sir, are the racist.
Because you're so embroiled in it that that's all you notice.
Exactly. Meanwhile, these are the people who, like when the lady on Fox News said that, well, you know, if the feds investigated any workplace's emails, they'd find tons of, you know, messages that portrayed Obama as a monkey or whatever. You know, it's like, no.
That's not actually true.
Yeah.
So there's that. Okay, that's just one of its many horrible problems. It is... unlike God's Not Dead, it is not viciously hateful toward non-believers. It treats them with disdain, and it positions them as people who need to be told and taught
and fixed.
And fixed. And every person in the film that has a negative character trait is a non-believer.
And it's also,
and the Christians are always. Yes. Patient and kind and loving and generous and helpful.
Yeah, you can trust anyone who wears a crucifix. Them any stranger in the hospital waiting room.
Anywhere you go.
And it portrays non-believers as being so virulently angry about everything all the time that, like, when the EMT and the nurse, like, hold hands and silently pray in a restaurant before eating, Sean Astin's like, ugh, why do they have to go around, you know, like,
proselytizing?
Yeah. It's like, oh, come on.
Right. It's a Christian film for stupid people.
Yeah, it's not even a Christian film for most Christians. I think most, you know, more and more on the web, I've been reading articles by Christian film, not necessarily even film critics, just people who sort of observe the culture.
Yeah.
Who are mortified by these stupid movies. You
and,
know?
And rightly so.
And are totally dead on about the fact that no one's being proselytized. Like, if Christians go to this movie and think, oh, it's so great, this movie's in the world, it's going to win over non-believers, and that's not happening. All this movie only exists to yes and a certain kind of sheltered cloister of super hardcore evangelicals who just want to see this kind of crap reflected back at them and kind of bask in its glow for 2 hours.
There is no nuance. There is no thoughtful understanding of human behavior. There is no good writing.
No.
There's no good direction. The production design is better than God's Not Dead because the budget is bigger and they got real actors this time around. And I'm saying even Brian Bosworth is a real actor in this scenario because he's not the worst actor in the world.
He's not terrible, no. Although, yeah, I just kept thinking, you know, Mira Sorvino, Oscar winner, doing all these things with, like, Brian Bosworth. Like, God, this is what Hollywood does to women.
Mira Sorvino is, I'm going to say this, she's actually not bad.
No, she's fine. I actually like Lee Majors, you know.
No.
I thought he was fine.
No.
And he gets stuck with the clunkiest dialogue, but right. I thought he sold it for the most part.
So it's a disaster.
The score is bad.
It's not an evil, toxic waste dump of a film like God's Not Dead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. I wouldn't even call it good bad, like in a way that, unless you were with a group of friends watching it.
Although, I will say this, these guys know how to press the buttons of the people who are already on board for this message.
Well, yeah,
based on
easy.
The two ladies sitting down the row from us.
They loved it.
They loved it. They laughed in all the right places. They cried in all the right places.
Yeah.
They left saying, oh, that was wonderful.
Right. Look, I've got friends on Facebook, old friends from back in the day in Texas, who are evangelical Christians, and I know of at least one of them who saw God's Not Dead and wrote on Facebook how much she loved it. And this is a person with a PhD.
Wow.
And I thought,
in theology,
are you so starved? Are you so starved for any positive representation of a Christian person in the media that you will accept this awful, awful movie? But kind of like back in the day in the early 90s when there weren't very many gay films.
Sure.
They would all come along and you'd be like, okay, I'm going to go see this because it's got a gay person in it. And I'm so fed up with never seeing a halfway decent, non-toxic gay person in a film.
But the difference is, though, that like some of those films had artistic merit.
Well, yes.
You know, Poison was, you know, it was an art film.
Poison's
an
art film.
And then, yes, you had to sit through Lie Down with Dogs or whatever junk because, you were just that starved for this stuff.
Right.
But, oh, brother. Yeah, you know,
oh, brother. Where art
why
thou?
Art thou?
Where art thou, good films?
I posted it ages ago on our podcast, but like if you look, there's a piece on Vox.com called "Why Are Christian Movies So Bad." There's another article that I dug up again recently called "Has There Ever Been a Bad Christian Movie?" You know, people are noticing that these movies are all terrible, and you know, and again, it's like, every time I would give a bad review to one of the Atlas Shrugged movies, inevitably some guy would be like, oh, well, you're liberal, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's like, no, you know, I know the difference between a good movie and a bad movie. And even if I could, if you had made a fun, interesting, well-acted, well-directed adaptation of that silly book, I would have been entertained by it. You know, I read the book, and I don't agree with the philosophy, but I, you know, it was a page-turner, and I think you could have made a fun, junky movie out of that book, and yeah, again, I wouldn't have agreed with the philosophy, but the story would have carried me along, but those are terrible movies, and these Christian movies, even though I am not one, I can objectively say they are terrible movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
DVD picks.
Holiday.
Ah. Nice.
Watched it last night.
Yeah.
On Turner Classic Movies. I'd never seen it before.
The other Philip Barry play starring Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant besides The Philadelphia Story, both directed by George Cukor.
I was not expecting what I got from this movie. Yeah, I'm thinking, no, Philadelphia Story. George Cukor. This is going to be really lighthearted. This movie, it takes place in a giant box.
Well, it is one of those adaptations of a play where they don't really open it up very much.
But this is an intentional.
Nor should they.
This
have.
Is an intentional not opening up. This is about like how being spectacularly wealthy
can be a trap.
Will suffocate you and kill you inside, and everyone in the film who is super rich is pretty miserable.
Mm.
Thanks, Cary Grant coming along to be like, hey, I'm not rich at all, and I'm going to go see the world and have a good time and having to learn about life and just why do I have to work? And, or not why do I have to work, but why do we work?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's the point of it?
What's the point of this anguished toil to make money? Mm. And he's about to marry the daughter, one of the daughters of the rich man.
Hepburn's sister.
She's into it. Like, she's into getting married. She's into having money and a house and servants and all that stuff. Mm. Katharine Hepburn, she wants out.
Yeah.
And she wants out so much that she actually, within the giant mansion, she retreats almost entirely to the childhood playroom.
Right.
Where she just hangs out all the time. The one scene, with the exception of the beginning and the end of the film, where Cary Grant gets out of the taxi cab and goes to visit his friends, Edward Everett Horton and Jean Dixon? Yeah, is that right? Is that the name?
Jean Dixon was an astrologer.
Yeah, but this actress's name was Jean Dixon, too, I think. Anyway, and then the end, when they're on the boat, when they finally do escape, there's only one moment, really, in the film where you think, you know, the space opens, and that's, they're at the window, either in her bedroom or in the playroom, Katharine Hepburn's, and
there's a Jean Dixon in this movie, but she doesn't play.
Yes.
Okay, so you're right. Sorry. Yes. All right. Sorry.
Of course I'm right.
Stopped clock.
They're almost gonna kiss. Like they shouldn't be almost about to kiss because, you know, he's engaged to her sister.
Right.
But they are clearly falling for each other. And the window is open. It's midnight on New Year's Eve, and the window's wide open. And they're both like leaning out the window, sort of like, "Can we get out of here, please?"
Can't breathe.
Yeah. It's a fascinating movie. It's funny. It's not the ha 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 kind of funny that I was thinking it was going to be. It's much darker than that. It's fantastic. So yeah, watch that.
Good choice. Mine is Vincent and Teo, which is a Robert Altman film from sort of his, you know, the lost years, like after he had kind of like blown his Hollywood wad and nobody was giving him the big budgets anymore. And before he sort of had his, you know, late era comeback with The Player, you know, he was doing stuff for television and he did, you know, a few sort of small films in Europe. And this was one of them. It stars Tim Roth as Vincent van Gogh. And Paul Reese as his, you know, ever-suffering patient brother, Teo, who sort of, you know, like, supported him financially and tried to sell his work and that kind of thing. It's a really fascinating portrait of an artist. And it's interesting to see it from Altman's point of view in that it was this period where he could not get arrested as a filmmaker and, you know, making a film about an artist who was completely ignored during his lifetime and who nobody appreciated what he was trying to do. And so it kind of adds, I think, another sort of level of, you know, yeah, I'm feeling you, you know, to what could have been just sort of another standard kind of biopic about an artist. It's no Lust for Life. This is a much grittier movie, and Roth's performance is really great, and Paul Reese is really good too. I think this is the first time it's coming out on Blu-ray, and it's really beautifully shot, and I think a lot of people don't know it exists or never saw it. So, Vincent and Teo.
Letters.
Okay.
All right. This is from M.A. Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Dear David Alonso, here is a list of my favorite punk rock movies.
Yeah.
That either have an accompanying soundtrack or at least should. He goes 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You've probably seen more of these than I have, but
number 5, The Decline of Western Civilization.
Mm.
Great documentary by Penelope Spheris, showcasing then up and coming bands in the punk scene in Los Angeles. Alice Bag, Black Flag, Catholic Discipline, Circle Jerks, Fear, Germs, X. What is he saying? He says, sad to say, no soundtrack produced. That's actually not true. I bought that soundtrack when I was a senior in high school. Slash Records put
that
out. Why
is it still not out on DVD? Is it some music rights thing?
I don't know why. It's hard to come by, though.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I've seen Decline 2 and 3, but not 1.
That movie was very much an important part of my
I'm sure it was
young adult life. But there, in fact, absolutely, certainly, totally was, there was a soundtrack put out on Slash Records. I bought it when I was a senior in high school because Darby Crash is on the cover and he's got blood trickling down his cheek and it scared me. And I was like, I have to buy this. Suburbia, filmed in 1983, also from Penelope Spheres. Yeah. Did you see this one?
I have not.
This is another one that was, this is a much more... melodramatic. It's a, you know, it's a narrative.
It's a narrative, yeah.
Film, yeah. This Roger Corman produced movie looks more like a late 1970s after school special about the kind of kids your parents didn't want you to befriend. and the Pet Shop Boys song Suburbia is based on this film.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yeah. SLC Punk.
I never saw that one.
Filmed
either.
In 1998, loosely based on the life of writer-director James Merendino of Descendants and All fame. This film does have a soundtrack featuring the talents of the Suicide Machines, the Exploited, Fear, the Stooges, Ramones, Blondie, Generation X, the Adolescents, Dead Kennedys, Minor Threat.
Am I wrong in thinking that you weren't a fan of that one? Or
I didn't really like it that
yeah,
much.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Number two, The Return of the Living Dead, comedy horror from 1985 at its most commercial, which means great soundtrack, TSOL, The Damned, 45 Grave, The Cramps, Flesh Eaters, Tall Boys.
The Cramps had a song on that soundtrack called Surfin' Dead that I used to play on college radio all the time.
Yes, number one, Repo Man.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the most quotable action comedies of the 80s, hard-to-find soundtrack. Contains Iggy Pop, Circle Jerk, Suicidal Tendencies, Black Flag, The Plugs, Fear, Burning Sensations. Thank you, M.A. Ross. Now,
believe it or not,
I
had the Repo Man soundtrack.
Why did you
on cassette?
Why?
I think I'd gotten it from Columbia House or something. And I used to listen to it in my car.
You were so punk.
I was so punk. I was a punker.
Okay, so are we supposed to knife this? There's only five films. So that makes 20... That's a 20...
20%.
20% each one. So we don't like SLC.
So, yeah, I'm trusting you on that one. So that's an 80...
You're still 80% knife with your... With your, with your punk movies.
Yeah.
M.A. Ross. Thank you.
That's a passing grade.
Yeah. What else do I got? Hang on.
By the way, we mentioned the movie Quinceañera. We should talk about the fact that Richard Glatzer passed away recently.
Yes, he did.
After a long battle with ALS.
You knew him more than I did.
I knew him a little bit.
I met him once because he wrote for Glue magazine.
Right.
Which was one of the first magazines that employed me when we moved to Los Angeles. And I met him once in passing at Laurie's, the editor, Laurie Pike, at Laurie's house.
I don't want to be one of those people that, like, somebody dies and, like, oh, yes, he was my best friend. You know, we would run into each other occasionally. We knew each other professionally. He directed Grief, which was one of the...
I really like.
Yeah, which really is one of the
movie Grief.
A terrific film of the sort of the new queer cinema of the early 90s. And a lot of friends of ours were in it. You know, Craig Chester and Catherine Canella, Jackie Beat, Alexis Arquette. And I would see Richard periodically, and then he and his partner Wash Westmoreland did The Fluffer and then Quinceañera, which won the Audience Award and the Jury Prize at Sundance that year. And then they did The Last of Robin Hood, and then most recently, obviously, Still Alice, which just won the Best Actress Oscar. But Richard also, you know, had worked in reality TV, and he... was actually very involved in the first several seasons of America's Next Top Model, which I thought was really cool. And then I didn't even know until he died, and I read his obit, that he had come from academia. Like, he had, like, a master's in English literature.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he, you know, did a lot of things over the course of his life. And when he got sick, he kept working. He wanted to. Like, Wash was saying somewhere that, you know, when it looked like, you know, he had a certain amount of time left. He was like, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to Paris? He was like, no, I want to make another film.
Right.
You know, and they made a movie about a woman dealing with illness, you know, in the way that Richard was. He could only communicate, like, by very slowly typing on a keyboard. In fact, they did Outfest Legacy did a screening this year of Grief for the 20th anniversary.
Right.
And he appeared, I think, via Skype and could only type on the keyboard with his toe.
Really?
Yeah, that was the only way he could communicate. But apparently, but you know, talked about making the film and that kind of thing. And so he's, you know, just an amazing cat and really talented. And whenever I did cross paths with him, he was always very sweet and very, you know, fun to talk to and a good guy. And so, yeah, he died and it sucks. But, you know, he leaves behind an interesting body of work. And, you know, his partner Wash, and you know, he made an impact.
More letters?
More letters, yes.
Okay. Dear Alonzo and Dave, having followed Alonzo's criticism going back to the Rotten Tomatoes show.
Woo!
Yeah.
That was a blast from the past.
Which I still miss.
Me too.
To his writings on the rap. And then to What the Flick, I am somewhat ashamed that it took me this long to discover Linoleum Knife.
Well, better late than never.
I have come to love the soothing kitchen table vibe. We're soothing?
We are at our kitchen table.
Which makes for a very pleasant walk to school, at least one morning a week. It's a long walk if you're listening to the whole thing.
Yeah.
With the added benefit of making me feel even more like an uncultured hick than I already do.
Oh, stop.
It also gives me hope that in another 10 years, my husband and I will be sitting around our own kitchen table squabbling over something, although our podcast would be far less interesting, and neither of us is fortunate enough to sound like Tom Waits.
That's a new one.
Romeo is bleeding. You're innocent when you dream. Moving on, I suppose it is the rite of passage for a fan to have his, her top 10 knifed, and my dreadful taste will probably earn me a whopping 0. Number 10. The Thin Blue Line. That's really good.
That's a great one, which actually is Criterion is putting out this week on Blu-ray.
Number 9, Beauty and the Beast, 1991
Disney. Oh, love version. It.
He says, because I am a 10-year-old girl trapped in the body of a gay man in his late 30s. 8, The Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic. Number 7, The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Number 6, The Manchurian Candidate.
Yes.
Number 5, Blade Runner.
Sure.
Number 4, Boogie Nights.
Okay.
Number 3, The Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
Number 2, Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
Number 1, Charade.
Dude.
I don't, where's
the bad taste?
Where's the dreadful taste? You've got 100% knifed.
No question.
List and, yeah.
That's like the humble brag of... Of
I've got such bad taste.
Oh, please don't knife me.
Please. All 10 of my films are from Hu Xiaoxian.
I'm so embarrassed. Such a hick.
That's from Turner.
And he's married to Hooch.
He lives in New York City. How many times do you think he's heard the Turner and Hooch joke? Dear Turner, please respond and tell us how many times people have used Turner and Hooch on you. Thank you very much. Okay, one more and then we're done.
Okay.
One more letter. And that letter is...
I can't get the Tom Waits image out of my head now.
Okay, wait. This letter has 3 lists and a long letter. Hang on. No, that's not happening today.
We'll save it for a deader week.
Okay, all the rest of these are lists, so we're done.
I think the Brian Saar letter only has like a mini list in it.
Which one is that?
Our friend Brian.
Hang on.
It's, you know, a shameless plug for his blog, but I'm happy to do that.
Okay. His blog, Brian's blog, is RupertPupkinSpeaks.
Correct.
.com.
Which I think he's also... No, but on Twitter, he's Bob... at Bob Friedlander?
Yes.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, my note to you is completely self-serving, and I apologize, but hopefully maybe some of slight interest to your listeners. So, Alonzo, I've noticed how you so generously plug the Criterion cast as part of your weekly outro, and that is really very cool of you. I just wanted to make mention of the fact that the Criterion cast has several shows that pop up in their feed, like The Newsstand, where they discuss the newest Criterion announcements, Eclipse viewer, where they exclusively talk about Criterion's Eclipse series. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that is. What
that's
is
like, the you Eclipse know, those boxes series. They put out, like the remember that one that I had that was the that Aaron gave me, the Lubitsch musicals, or there was the one of all the William Klein movies.
Right. There's one called Off the Shelf and a few more. I am actually one of the co-hosts of the Off the Shelf show. Ryan Gallagher was kind enough to invite me to be a part of the podcast, and now we discuss the latest Blu-ray and DVD releases each week. The show usually comes out on Wednesdays. We geek out about not only the Criterion label, but also smaller labels like Twilight Time, Kino Lorber Studio Classics, Scorpion, Olive, and others. If any of your listening audience is into older films and Blu-rays, I would think they might dig the program.
Okay.
If there's any way of mentioning Off the Shelf on your show, it would be hugely appreciated.
We just did.
We are just doing that right now. Okay, on to my second list. So on to my second bit of shameless self-promotion. I am currently running a series on my site, Rupert Pupkin Speaks, called Underrated 85. I and some other contributors are putting together lists of our favorite underrated movies from 30 years ago. It's been fun, and I'd be curious to hear what some of your favorite underrated classics from 1985 are.
I'd have to go look
that up, but we'll next week.
Yeah.
I will be continuing this list series over the next several months with underrated 75, underrated 65, and so forth. Hopefully, it might be a source of some possible film viewing recommendations for folks who might happen to check these lists out. And here are my five underrated 1985 films. And he says, this is for knifing purposes. Mm. Number five, The New Kids from Sean Cunningham.
Didn't see that one. I remember
it. Me neither.
You know, Sean Cunningham directed the original Friday the 13th.
Yes. Rustler's Rhapsody.
Never seen it. I've always heard it was terrible.
I've never seen that one either. The Journey of Natty Gant, which I have seen and is great.
Okay. I haven't seen it.
Perfect.
Seriously, Brian?
Yeah, seriously, apparently.
That movie's awful. And I mean, it's fun, but it's terrible.
Into the Night. John Landis.
I'm not a big fan of that one either.
Okay, I've seen The Journey of Natty Gann, and I have seen Perfect. I haven't seen the other three, so you get 100% because I'm benefit of the doubting you here.
Well, I'm not giving him Into the Night or Perfect, so...
Oh, you?
No.
All right, well, then you're 60%.
No,
five movies.
Right.
Only five films.
But you get 50 and I get 50, so that's 80, because I'm giving him...
All right, sure, whatever.
Yeah, so 80.
80.
You're passing.
Thank you kindly for indulging me, and please know that I continue to be devoted to your show and listen every week to help me decide which new movies I should bother with and which I should forget about. You are both awesome, and so is your podcast, Brian. Thank you, Brian.
Brian is currently putting together a documentary about one of my... the most influential film critics, Danny Peary, the guy who wrote the cult movies series and Guide for the Film Fanatic. And I was fortunate enough to be interviewed for that film. And I am looking forward to that project coming to fruition because Peary does not really get the credit he deserves. But I think a lot of movie nerds grew up reading his stuff and seeking out movies that he pointed us to. And so it's very cool that Brian is taking this on as a project and kind of giving this guy his due.
We're finished.
All right. As always, we thank you for listening. And, of course, we remind you to check out the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode, our most recent one being The Poseidon Adventure. It costs $1.99, and it is a full-length, movie-length commentary track that you can listen to alongside the movie or just watch or listen to it on its own. We also have special episodes devoted to Clue, Josie and the Pussycats, Two for the Road, and The Apple. And you can get those by PayPaling $1.99 each to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Oh, hey!
And include your email address so we know where to send them.
So, coming soon, we are going to set up a subscription service. Yes.
The show will remain free.
Yeah. Nothing's changing. The show's going to be free. The show's always free. You're not paying for anything unless you buy a
special episode.
We're going to start a subscription service, and we're going to have, you know, perks. We're going to have things that you get at various levels of donation. This is going to be a way for you to have extra stuff. Now, we've got a list of some stuff. We're not going to tell you what that stuff is.
I'll try and set up a survey on Facebook, maybe.
But if you have any ideas out there of stuff you think you would feel would be, like, great... That you want.
Things that say linoleum knife on them.
Or things that we would do, or things that you could get somehow. Let us know. Email us at linoleum whatever, whatever, at whatever.
Oh my God.
What is it again?
This show's been on the air for 4.5 years.
I know, but what is it again?
It's linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
I'm going to try and set up a survey.
Just brainstorm. There's no... Right or wrong answers.
There's no wrong answers in brainstorming.
In brainstorming.
I'm going to set up something on our Facebook page. Either it'll be a survey or just a thing where I say, hey, what are your ideas? And you can just leave them as a comment. You know, of course, we would have t-shirts, which we've already been doing. But,
yeah. You
know, do you want shot glasses? Do you want TV-related episodes? Do you want...
Well, we can tell them about that. We've been kicking around for like 4 months now. The idea of an extra podcast... Mm-hmm. That would be for subscribers only.
Right.
People who subscribed and donated like
certain level.
Subscribed at a certain level. A television podcast called LKTV.
Right. And it would literally just be, here's what we watched this week.
And meanwhile, as we've been thinking about this for several months, all these people we know are putting out TV podcasts now. So it's time.
Yes.
It's time we start doing that. And it would be even less professional and less comprehensive than this podcast.
Yes.
But that's a thing that I think is definitely should be one of the perks
on
the subscription model. A subscriber-only podcast that's all television.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Because I watch a lot of really amazing TV. And it's I don't have very many people to talk about it with because my viewing... choices are so specialized.
Yes. So, and yeah, none of it, we're not really watching the same things even, so
we'll no, we're not.
Sort of telling each other about the stuff that we're watching alone. So yeah, we would love to hear from you about this, but I'll set up a question on our Linoleum Knife Facebook page, which you should totally go and like if you haven't already. And you can also email us any suggestions at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. But anyway, thank you to Blue, as always, for our theme music. You can find out more about his wonderful work at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out over at Earpop, or Wolfpop, sorry, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, the Canon and Malton on Movies. Also, check out Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney, the Schmoes Know, Fat Guys of the Movies, of course, as always, the Criterion cast, the Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash. Oh, no, that's not even happening anymore. I should scratch that one out.
What is it?
Pod crashes on hiatus.
Is it really?
Yeah. Game Night Guys and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show at iTunes. Thank you to the listener who said that we were the Moonquake Lake of podcasts. That's a lot to live up to, but we'll do our
best.
That's
Robert. I'm blanking on his last name. He just followed me on Twitter yesterday.
Well, thank you, Robert. We appreciate that.
I'm D. Leland White on Twitter, by the way.
And I'm at A. Duraldi.
Leland is my middle name, L-E-L-A-N-D. You can find me on Twitter at D. Leland White.
But we love positive reviews on iTunes. It does help people find the show. It gives us better placement on their sort of home pages. You can also stream this show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us a thumbs up there as well. Again, like our Facebook page. Also join our Linoleum Knife group page where our listeners talk to each other about movies and whatnot. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. I have added a couple of more episodes from back in the day, from the early days of this show to check out. Our Twitter, you can follow us at LinoleumCast in addition to our individual accounts. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you with questions, comments, and top 10 lists and whatever else. And of course, you can visit our website at linoleum-knife.com. Yeah.
We're fixing to go get fancy in the opera.
We've got to go put on our tails for the opera. So we'll catch you guys
next time. We're going to see The Rabbit of Seville.
Yes.
Here's what you are not going to do. you're not going to start hitting my leg in those during those portions of the...
I would never.
Yes, you would.
It's a given that we're going to hear that, so I'm not going to be
excited.
Why
do you want to kill the web?
No, no, that wrong one.
Wait, is it right? Wait.
No, that's sure? That's the Wagner one. That's What's Opera Doc.
This is
the, come into my shop, I will dust your crop.
Right, but that's, yes.
Daintily.
Right.
Kill the Wabbit one is for
they
the Wagner
one. They say it in both. They say
no,
it in both.
No.
Yeah.
No, they don't. We'll go to the tote on this one.
Mark your my words.
You don't question me about Bugs Bunny. You will be sorry. Anyway, it's been lovely. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.